I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. In a few minutes, a look at the rise of gambling, and a professor crunches the numbers to see if casinos really do attract those who can at least afford to gamble. But first, life-threatening infections from drug-resistant superbugs are not just for hospitals anymore. That's the headline of an article in the Journal of the American Medical Association today about a study that indicates that staph infections are probably killing more Americans each year than AIDS, statistics that JAMA calls astounding. In the past week alone, a 4-year-old preschooler in New Hampshire and a high school student from Virginia died from staph infections. Virginia school officials have shut down 21 schools for cleaning. In New Hampshire, staph infections also raced through high school football locker rooms this fall. Well, joining us from Nashville, Tennessee, Dr. William Schaffner, infectious disease expert at the Vanderbilt Medical Center. He was involved in the JAMA study. Dr. Schaffner, this bacteria is called MRSA. What does that stand for, and why is it such a superbug?
The MRSA means methicillin-resistant Staphylococcus aureus.
And again, why is this superbug so super?
It's super because, first, it has the capacity to get about in the community. This has been a major change over the last 5 years in the United States and other countries also. So this staph has spreading in the community. And then secondly, it's super because some of the strains are resistant to some antibiotics. But fortunately, in our pharmacies, we have other antibiotics that can still work and can cure these infections, of course, with the proviso that we get them early enough. So there is this interest in making sure that individuals who think they may be infected go call their doctors or go to the emergency room promptly.
And get the right antibiotic. We understand there are different forms of this infection. It can be a blood infection or the so-called flesh-eating infection. What are the symptoms? How does it first surface?
Well, staphylococci live in human beings, and they reside quietly in the front of the nose. And occasionally then when we get abrasions on our skin, the staph enter that place and cause local infections. These staphylococcal skin infections frequently present in a way that looks kind of like just a spider bite, and then they get worse over the next several days rather quickly.
Huh. We had a fellow on our program a couple years ago who caught one of these infections in a locker room and had to have much of his flesh cut away from his leg until it got ahead of the infection. How would someone know, for instance, the difference between a blood infection and a flu?
The patient wouldn't know except that they were very, very sick. And that brings them to the hospital, often with fever and chills, and then maybe some symptoms referable to a part of the body where the staph organisms are beginning to set up shop. For example, in the lung with pneumonia, they would start having chest pain and difficulty breathing and coughing up sputum. The trick will be for the doctor to quickly recognize what's going on, and fortunately, doctors are very astute at picking up staphylococcal infections, and even before the precise diagnosis is made, instituting appropriate therapy.
Well, so you're saying that even at that height of illness, these infections could possibly be treatable. But then why do we have these alarming numbers of deaths?
The alarming numbers are that, first of all, this is becoming a much more common infection in the community. We used to think of staph infections as associated with very debilitated patients in the hospital. That's still true, but we have a new variant that is now getting around in the community, and people are coming in with these infections. If they're not treated promptly, and of course, if they affect people of advanced age who are frail, who don't have a good immune system, then we're going to have some deaths, because around the country over the last 2 or 3 years, these sorts of staph infections are now the most common cause of skin infections in people coming into emergency rooms. It accounts for over 60% of people coming into skin infections here at Vanderbilt in Nashville in our ER.
Huh. And again, where are people picking it up as they come into your ER?
It's spread through close, intimate contact from person to person. There have been certain locations where we've had outbreaks. athletic teams, particularly football teams. There have been prison and jail outbreaks. So in those circumstances, the coaches and the folks who run the jails and prisons are now being much more obsessive about hygiene. Every coach now in this country knows about these staff infections and is making sure that particularly teenage boys don't share towels, absolutely take showers after every practice, and take their uniforms and T-shirts home and have them laundered.
Does it have anything to do, Doctor, with, you know, we had been told, oh, there's, you know, all these superbugs out, so everybody started buying antibacterial soaps and things. And what we understood was that the more you use antibacterial material, the more a bacteria will try to find a way to overcome it, and that's how we helped create superbugs. Is that a part of this story?
It is a good thought, but it's not exactly part of this story because these bugs are not resistant to what's in those hand-washing products. So we're fortunate in that regard, but it's something we're keeping our eye on.
Huh. Well, given that, washing your hands, though, still does help.
Oh, washing hands helps a great deal because there are elements of personal hygiene here. Let's think about those high school football players, and we've had numerous outbreaks in that kind of setting. These are young boys who will hang up a sweaty T-shirt and let it dry out, and the next day in practice, put it on again. They'll share towels. They won't take showers after each of their practices. And so coaches have cleaned up and made much more hygienic locker rooms and have insisted on not sharing towels, taking showers, using soap every time you take a shower, and the like. And that, all of those simple hygienic measures have made locker rooms much safer from this MRSA.
Dr. William Schaffner, infectious disease expert at the Vanderbilt Medical Center in Nashville, Tennessee, thanks so much for helping us out with this today.
Good to be with you, Robin.
Casino gambling. Remember when it was considered such a vice you had to travel to Las Vegas or Atlantic City to play, returning with a whiff of indecency? Well, today, casino gambling adds $5 billion a year to state coffers across the U.S., and states without casinos are jockeying to get a piece of that action. Kansas will soon become the first state to own and operate its own large-scale resorts. And in Kentucky, the incumbent governor made gambling his number one issue, airing ads taking aim at gambling in Illinois in his reelection campaign, saying it increased bankruptcies, divorces, and crime. Well, here where we are in Massachusetts, Governor Deval Patrick has a plan to allow three casinos to open. The city is abuzz with debate.
I have always thought of Massachusetts as just a little bit above easy money.
I think it's good. I think it's good for the public, for, you know, people to enjoy. So why not?
The problems that may arise from legalized gambling, you know, crime and all that stuff, I think it's exaggerated.
We need this money to build places for the homeless, especially for the children that are on the street.
I just hit the jackpot down at Foxwoods for $1,600.
Well, that is Foxwoods Casino in neighboring Connecticut, and maybe one of the reasons that Massachusetts is considering casino gambling. The governor figures it's better to have people spend their gambling dollars here than someplace else. Pam Prah of Stateline.org has been covering the rise of gambling across the country. She joins us now. And Pam, that seems to be the motivating factor for other states as well. You call it keeping up with the Joneses?
That's right. All the states are, as you say, jockeying for what they see as easy money from gambling.
And why? What do they plan on doing with it?
Actually, the states that have gambling, it ranges from 5% to 10% of their budgets come from gambling money. Nevada, with Las Vegas casinos, the state budget is almost 40% comes from the casinos. So it's a big chunk of change.
And tell us, how many states have casinos, not just slots or, you know,
right,
tracks? How many have big casinos?
Well, 11 states currently have casinos now. Pennsylvania and Kansas are both working on getting them. And then there's also the Indian casinos. The American Indian casinos are in 28 states.
And 12 states, we should add, we learned from you, have so-called racisons?
Racinos.
Racinos.
They're called racinos. Basically, that's putting some sort of casino entertainment at a racetrack, and most often it's slots.
Yeah. How does it work in most states? I mean, how do they make the money from the casino? Do they bid it out? How do they make their money?
In most states, the state bids it out, and there's a very complicated licensing procedures that each state goes through.
And then the state takes a percentage of the take of the casino.
That's right.
Well, tell us more about Kansas, because Kansas will soon become the first state to actually own the casinos. How would that work?
Right. This is a little bit unusual, and states are watching this carefully. Kansas will own the operation, including the buildings. In other states, the buildings and things like that, private contractors own.
And what are some of the concerns about states actually owning the casinos?
Well, the concern is that, you know, the state is supposed to be regulating the casino to make sure that it's following all the rules. So if you own it, the lines get a bit blurred.
Right.
But this isn't unusual for other countries. I mean, some casinos in Canada operate this way.
Yeah. By the way, as states are all jockeying to, you know, keep their gamblers from crossing borders into other states and losing that that money from those gamblers, is this likely to be a trend of states owning casinos?
Depending on how it works in Kansas, I think so. A few years back, Maryland was considering this. It didn't happen, but it could resurface.
And by the way, do they make more money if they own it?
Yes. That's why Kansas is doing it. Yeah. They think that they can make more money with this arrangement.
And by the way, we talked about how, you know, there was one time, you know, over 30 years ago when this was a vice. Why are states more accepting of it?
Well, I think part of the reason is Americans are more accepting more of it. It's more entertainment. A lot of the casinos have other things built around it, so families can plan vacations so that mom and dad can hit the casino while the kids do something else.
You also spoke to a professor at Boston College's Carroll School of Management, that's Richard McGowan, and he said that, well, once they see also that this money goes to pay for education or programs for seniors or property tax relief, their fears of sin seem to fade.
Right. But I think one thing that some folks don't understand is that this isn't extra money. Let's say the lottery brings $3 million into the state coffers, and it's supposed to be for education. That doesn't mean the education is going to get $3 million on top of what the state would have already provided. They're kind of just divvying up the pot a little differently.
Right. It's the only money that education is going to get in many cases. Well, I know you have a list of states that are, you know, have budget problems that are looking to gambling dollars. Can you just tick off what they are and what they're considering?
Well, Maryland is once again considering legalizing slot machines at racetracks, the racinos that we talked about. They're hoping to bring in $550 million by doing that. They have a more than a $1.7 billion deficit, but it's very controversial here in nearby Maryland. Michigan, which is battling a recession, is considering putting slots at racetracks. Illinois is considering adding casinos, including one in Chicago, and they would use the money for construction projects. The governors of Florida and California are looking at reworking their compacts with the Indian tribes, trying to get bigger take for the state. Unlike commercial casinos, states can't tax an Indian operation, but they can work out a deal with them to get some revenue.
That's Pam Prah of Stateline.org. They took a look at the rise in gambling across the country. And by the way, you can take a look at what they found at our website, here-now.org. Pam, thanks so much.
Thank you.
And when we come back, do casinos unfairly target the poor here and now? I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now, and today we've been looking nationwide at the trend of states building gambling casinos to boost revenue. As we said, Massachusetts is considering allowing three casinos to open for business, and that's caused a huge debate about the moral and economic implications of casino gambling. Boston Globe columnist Steve Bailey argues that if states need more revenue, they should raise taxes. So, for instance, if roads need repairing, tax the people who use them through a gas tax. And Bailey says that state gambling programs suck the money out of people who can least afford it. Well, is casino gambling a regressive tax, a so-called backdoor tax that unfairly targets the poor? Professor Erwin Morris has studied that question. He's director of graduate studies for government and politics at the University of Maryland College Park. Professor, welcome.
Thank you very much.
Well, first of all, give us some examples of a regressive tax outside of gambling.
A sales tax is a regressive tax, which means that people in lower income brackets pay a higher percentage of their income in tax. Some people think, let's say a flat income tax is a regressive tax. So let's say you pay 10% or 15% across the board on earned income. All right? And so people who basically make all of their money from a wage job would pay 10 or 15%, whatever the flat tax is, whereas someone who is in a much higher income category would likely have earnings from stocks or various or bonds or other non-earned income. Well, that would all be what? That would all be ignored by the flat tax.
Well, you've done research to find out whether or not casinos and gambling act as sort of a regressive tax. What did you find, first of all? What's your profile of a casino gambler?
Well, most casino gamblers are going to be middle or upper middle income classes. They're not going to be from your lowest income categories or lowest income groups. So it's very hard for casinos to really be a significant regressive tax.
Why don't casinos attract people who are, you know, maybe lower middle income or, you know, because this is the concern that it's going to be a lower income or a lower middle income person who's got the itch, got an addiction, and they're going to maybe get in over their head. Why doesn't that happen?
Well, casinos are going to be, we're talking about what, three casinos in Massachusetts?
Mm-hmm.
All right, so the area in which it's going, there's going to be easy access is far, far smaller than a lottery. So you're going to have to be able to travel, except for right around the perimeter of the casinos. Mm-hmm. And so that's not going to be trivial as far as an expense is concerned. Two, lower income category don't have a monopoly on gambling addiction. There's no reason to think that gambling addictions vary that much mm-hmm. by income category. And so I think that's kind of a problematic assumption. And so casinos have a variety of games where there would be table limits that more or less put people in the lowest income categories outside the bars. Lotteries, on the other hand, you have a lot of people from lower income categories who spend a significant amount of money on lotteries. I mean, to walk into, you know, a convenience store and put down a dollar or two or five is a very different activity than going into a casino, driving 50 miles or whatever to a casino. For a lot of reasons, you'd expect lower-income individuals to gamble through the lottery as opposed to through casinos.
So do you see lotteries as a, you know, in a way, as sort of a regressive tax?
Lotteries are almost certainly a regressive tax.
Because, as you say, and lotteries do seem to be sold in, you know, five-and-dime stores, and they're more accessible to people of lower income, whereas casinos, you see people of middle and higher incomes going to casinos, so it doesn't have that sort of unfair burden on the poor.
At the state level, from the states that have casinos that we have now, there does not seem to be that burden on the poor. Now, mm-hmm. there may be a local level problem associated with crime or problems with social service provision around the casinos, but that's really a different issue.
Given that you see casinos as attracting people of middle or higher incomes, do you see this as a benefit to states to possibly switch their source of revenue from lotteries to casinos, you know, moving that regressive tax away from the poor?
Well, the problem is states don't do away with the lotteries. And if we are actually, let's say I'm right about their attracting different income categories, then there's not going to be a trade-off. There's just going to be more gambling.
And what do you see the trend across the U.S.? What do you see the gambling trend being?
Towards more. It's very difficult to limit gambling once it has been established. There are a few examples where certain types of gambling have been limited once they've been started. But for the most part, if a state gets a lottery, it keeps it. And for the most part, if a state establishes any kind of significant casino gambling, it also keeps it.
That's Professor Erwin Morris. He's Director of Graduate Studies for Government and Politics at the University of Maryland, College Park, talking to us about the impact of casino gambling on lower-income residents. And a quick note, Turkey was in the news today. Lawmakers in the Turkish parliament burst into applause after giving the green light to a possible offensive against Kurdish rebels in northern Iraq. Turkish leaders stressed that such an offensive would not immediately follow an authorization, and hours before the vote, Iraq's Prime Minister, Nouri al-Maliki, called his Turkish counterpart to say the Iraqi government was determined to stop what he called the terrorist activities of the Kurdistan Workers' Party, or the PKK, the would-be target targets of a Turkish assault. Today's vote comes as the U.S. Congress considers a resolution that would label the World War I era killing of more than a million Armenians in the final years of the Ottoman Empire as genocide, a move that has outraged modern-day Turks and unsettled the White House, which counts on Turkey to allow the U.S. military to stage from that country. Today, President Bush urged Congress to reconsider the resolution.
One thing Congress should not be doing is sorting out the historical record of the Ottoman Empire. The resolution on the mass killings of Armenians beginning in 1915 is counterproductive. Both Republicans and Democrats, including every living former Secretary of State, have spoken out against this resolution. Congress has more important work to do than antagonizing a Democratic ally in the Muslim world, especially one that's providing vital support for our military every day.
But this urging came as the president prepared to meet with the Dalai Lama, the exiled Tibetan monk considered a separatist by China, and the president's embrace of the Dalai has enraged China. Today, Bush addressed that issue saying, "I support religious freedom. He supports religious freedom," meaning the Dalai Lama. Well, tomorrow on Here and Now, the former State Department employee who developed the list, the names of Iraqis he's trying to get into this country because in Iraq they're in danger of being killed for working for the U.S. That's tomorrow. Still ahead today, hey, San Francisco, Los Angeles, will the last one out please turn out the light? Hey, would you turn out that light? That's what residents of San Francisco and Los Angeles will be asked to do between the hours of 8 and 9 this coming Saturday night. The plea is coming from Nate Tyler, a former Google spokesperson, now executive director of Lights Out America. He joins us now from San Francisco. And Nate, this idea of yours, it's called Lights Out Hour. It came to you during a visit to Sydney, Australia. We understand you were having dinner. Everything went dark, and you thought it was a power outage, right?
At the time, I wasn't sure what it was, and I asked our waiters. They brought the candle to our table, and they said it was part of a campaign down there called Earth Hour. And it suddenly occurred to me, what an amazing idea.
It's like the light bulbs went off in Australia and went on in your head. And so now you've come up with this idea of having, you know, this reenacted in San Francisco and Los Angeles. What are you asking for on the 20th? Because some people would say, what about safety issues? You know, I can't drive if suddenly the lights go out and I'm driving.
To be very clear, we're inviting people to turn off all non-essential lighting. So this doesn't mean streetlights or any kind of light that keeps people safe or healthy. Like, we're not asking hospitals to turn out lights, those mm-hmm. kinds of things. It's more just the lights that you and I can turn off in our houses or at work, the ones that we don't necessarily need.
You make a list, floodlights at used car lots, neon movie marquees, lights in empty buildings. You know, we live, of course, here in Boston, and sometimes you'll look up, and there is the city ablaze, and it's 1 a.m, and nobody's at work.
That is true, I think, in every city in this country, and we really need to do something about that.
Yeah. Well, now you are spreading the word about this lights out night. I mean, yeah, this is a grassroots thing. You're probably, as a former Google spokesperson, you're connected. And we know you've been sending out hundreds of emails. You had friends help you with websites and everything. But how does it work? Do people sign on, or are you just going to wait and see what happens?
We've been doing a couple things. People can sign up on our website at lightsoutsf.org and pledge that, you know, they're going to turn their lights out themselves.
How many have done that?
Many hundreds of people.
Mm.
And then businesses as well. The Golden Gate Bridge is going to turn out the lights on the main towers, the Bay Bridge, Alcatraz Island, City Hall, the Transamerica building, local businesses, Safeway, Esurance, the Gap. I've all signed on to participate.
Huh. Now, the point is, of course, to make a statement, but also to save energy, lower carbon emissions. How much, for instance, did they save in Sydney with that 1 hour?
So in Sydney, they saved 10% of the average energy used on a Saturday night.
That's the equivalent of taking 50,000 cars off the road for an hour?
Yeah, that's right. And it can be significant. I mean, if everybody does turn off their lights, there can be significant and important energy savings. We are also working with our local utility here, PG&E, to hand out 100,000 compact fluorescent light bulbs throughout the city. In addition to just turning out your lights for an hour, if everybody installs a light bulb, then there are some serious energy savings associated with that.
What are you going to do on that night at 8 o'clock?
Well, we're hosting a candlelight gathering in this park here called Dolores Park, which has a view of the city.
That's Nate Tyler. His group is Lights Out San Francisco. You're also doing this Lights Out Hour on October 20th in Los Angeles. And you wanted to go nationwide, but staying with Los Angeles, how are you going to get them? I mean, that's a nightlight city.
It is true. And in fact, since launching San Francisco, they came to us, and they're going to turn the lights out on City Hall and on the Hollywood sign and other county and city buildings down there.
Nate Tyler, thank you.
Thank you.
Again, Nate Tyler, Executive Director of Lights Out San Francisco. And one of the groups supporting his idea is the Arizona-based International Dark Sky Association. Joining us now, Pete Strasser. He's the group's Senior Technical Advisor. So, Peter, the unofficial mission of the Night Sky Association is to change the sky at night. You know, tell us some of the more scientific ways that, you know, turning the lights out and bringing the sky back. You know, tell us a little bit more about that, rather than just having this as a symbol.
Well, the beautiful thing about this particular project is the identification of lights that are unnecessary. It's not so much that you need to light up the roadway, as many of the luminaires or fixtures that are out there light up more than the roadway. And any light that's lighting up more than the roadway, or what that's intended to be lighted up, is wasteful.
You talk about something called sky glow. This is the Earth over the centuries getting brighter and brighter because we have more artificial lighting, and air pollution is reflecting that light back down to Earth.
Yes.
I know you have a way of measuring how bad this, you know, sky glow gets. It's a scale called the Bortle scale.
Bortle scale, yes. It's done to kind of signify how bad visibility is, or how much is reduced by sky glow. It's a scale that goes from 1 to 9, 1 being absolutely no light in the atmosphere from an unnatural source, 9 being the worst. As you can imagine, most of the East Coast is sitting around 7 to 9 as far as visibility being obscured. In continental United States, there's only 2 sites that are down to the 2 level, and that's in Utah, the canyons in Bryce National Monument. Going back to the 1, that would be what most people had from about 1910 all the way back. So the sky that Galileo looked at is nothing at all like what would be available today.
In fact, Galileo could see so much more with the naked eye or a poor telescope than we can see with the most high-powered telescopes today.
Absolutely, yeah. It's astonishing just what's lacking. I've seen the figure that 95% of children, people under 18 in America, have never seen the Milky Way.
Well, you know, some people say, well, you know what? That's what happens in evolution. You'll lose some things. I mean, why is it so important for people to have that experience?
I'd like to say that it doesn't have to happen. In this county where we are, Pima County in Tucson area, they enacted very simple ordinance restrictions, lights that essentially don't shine up. And I can see the Milky Way clearly from my driveway every night. And our town is no more dangerous or crime-ridden because we have good designed light fixtures. And by solving the problem, you save energy and you save money.
Well, in fact, we learned from you that the city of Calgary in Canada cut its electricity expenses by more than $2 million a year after switching over to shielded lights?
Yes. Essentially, imagine a light that doesn't have any shield and the light shines up. You put a shield on it, so light that's reflected now back down onto the ground. You need a less wattage bulb to achieve the same level of illumination on the ground. You save money, you save energy, just like that. Mm. And at the same time, you save the nighttime sky.
Well, and there are other reasons. We've spoken of aesthetics and energy and pollution. But apparently, some people feel there's a real health factor. Researchers are looking at the high incidence of breast cancer among women in industrialized nations and making a link between the disruption of circadian rhythms that control hormone production and exposure to artificial light.
Yes. If people are exposed to artificial light, melatonin synthesis is eliminated, and it's that melatonin which is supposed to have this cancer-protecting property.
Of course, this hasn't been proven, but it's being looked at.
Yes.
That's Pete Strasser. He's Senior Technical Advisor for the Tucson, Arizona-based International Dark Sky Association. And before him, we spoke with Nate Tyler. He's Executive Director of Lights Out San Francisco. They're going to have an hour of Lights Out on October 20th in San Francisco and Los Angeles. But they're also planning a nationwide Lights Out on March 29th. So to find out about all of that, go to our website, here-now.org. Pete, thanks so much.
Okay, thanks for having me on.
And just a second for a quick reminder here. While you're at the website, remember you can listen to programs stream live. For past programs, you can click on the archives. You can also download a podcast, take us with you wherever you go. It'll be probably the rare trip we get to make. That's here-now.org. Before we go today, author Mary Gordon takes an unsparing look at the life of her mom. You're listening to Here and Now. A new study seems to show that the deeper a man's voice, the more attractive he might be to a potential mate looking to have kids. Researchers studied the reproductive patterns of the Hadza, a tribe of hunter-gatherers in northern Tanzania, and they found the men of the tribe with lower voices fathered more children. So apparently in Darwin's Survival of the fittest sound like this.
Hi, this is Barry White.
Harvard anthropologist Corinne Apicella conducted the study. She joins us in the studio. Corinne, are all the men you know walking up to you and saying, "Hi, Corinne"?
Pretty much.
In our office, they are. That was Barry White. Of course, he fathered 8 children, and it's a reminder, you know, that there are men in this country with deep voices. You could have studied. Why did you go to Tanzania?
The Hadza are one of the last remaining hunter-gatherer populations left on the planet, and so they provide a really excellent window to our past. Another reason is they don't use any birth control.
Hmm.
So in our society, we might have these sorts of preferences for different traits, including maybe deep voice pitch in men, but whether or not they confer any reproductive advantage, it's really difficult to see.
Right, because there are so many other factors, like birth control.
Right.
So the Hadza, how did you conduct the study?
I had the men and the women actually come into the Land Rover with me, and I simply just gave them a microphone and I asked them to say hujambo, which is a Swahili word, and it loosely translates to hello in English. And I asked them, you know, how many children were born to you, how many are still surviving, so I was able to calculate the child mortality rate.
Mm. Let's listen to a collection of Hadza men saying hujambo to you.
Okay, excellent.
Hujambo.
Ujambo.
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 It doesn't really sound that different. Did you have to then measure who had the lowest voice?
Yeah, to me, I can pretty much tell that the second voice we heard and the last one were probably the deepest, but sometimes it's not always obvious to the human ear. So we just have this simple program that measures voice pitch. It's actually determined by the rate of vibration of the vocal cords. And basically, the longer and thicker your vocal cords, the deeper your voice pitch is.
Let's listen again.
Ujambo.
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 So you say the second and the last?
Yeah, and I think also the third.
And the third. And so the man with the deepest voice, how many children did he have?
He had actually fathered 10 children, of which 9 were still surviving. And you can compare that with the man with the highest pitched voice in our study. He fathered 3 children, of which only 1 was still living.
Is reproductivity actually related to a deeper voice? In other words, are you then, once a mate chooses you, able to produce more children?
We know that men with deeper voice, their children don't have a higher mortality rate. It seems like they're just having more children. So whether or not they have access to maybe more mates, whether or not maybe they start reproducing earlier, it could also be that maybe deeper voice pitch is related to something that we haven't even thought of, something like testosterone, in which case maybe it's predictive of hunting ability. And if you're a good hunter, you're able to bring more food home to your spouse. And if you bring more food home to your spouse after she has a child, she might be able to resume ovulation more quickly. And so you might actually be at an advantage because you have shorter interbirth intervals between children.
Who knew? What does it mean to you as an anthropologist?
Well, one thing I wanted to stress is that, well, this might be one quality that we look at when we're selecting our mates. I've heard a lot of friends say, oh, I love his voice. It's really beautiful. It's very deep. But this is only one of a lot of qualities that we look for when we're choosing mates. So other things like personality, religion, political preferences, physical attractiveness, all of those sorts of things are also taken into consideration.
But I guess it's good to know that there may be things that we're not aware of that are triggering an age-old response.
That's right.
Yeah. By the way, let's hear the women's voices. You spoke to the female Hadza as well.
Ujambo.
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 Do men choose their mate based on their voice?
Well, studies here do suggest that men do like women who have higher pitched voices. They perceive them to be more attractive, healthier, younger, more feminine. But in the Hadza, we actually didn't find it to be related to reproductive outcomes, voice pitch. But this may not mean that it isn't related to fecundity or fertility.
Corinne Apicella is a doctoral candidate in the Department of Anthropology at Harvard University. Her study of the Hadza in Tanzania, which found a link between the pitch of a male voice and the number of children he fathers, deeper voice equaling more kids, appears in the journal Biology Letters. Corinne, thanks so much for coming to talk to us about it.
You're welcome. Thank you for having me.
Back with Mary Gordon, here and now. Author Mary Gordon has mined her family history before. Her highly praised memoir, The Shadow Man, was an unsparing look at her beloved father, a Jew who converted to Catholicism, an intellect and failed businessman who died when she was 7. Well, now she takes on the other half of her bloodline. Her new collection of essays is called Circling My Mother, and it's something she does throughout the book, looking at her late mother through several different lenses to try to bring the complicated picture into focus.
My mother's story is a story of physical affliction, polio, alcoholism, senile dementia, and of an historical moment importantly colored by the experience of immigration, World War, and the Great Depression. It is the story of a particular moment in American Catholicism and of the American working class. My mother was born in 1908. She died in 2002. So it is also the story of time and the effects of time.
That's Mary Gordon reading from her book, Circling My Mother, and she joins us now with more. Welcome.
Thank you, Robin.
The effects of time, they do ravage your mother in the end. In fact, she doesn't even know you. She thinks your name is Snapple.
Yes.
Because you give her a bottle of Snapple.
Yes. No, she ceased to recognize me several years before she died. And so then going to visit someone regularly who doesn't know who you are is, to say the least, a very difficult and painful experience.
So you want to find the joy that there was, because there was joy. Take us back to the beginning. Place your mother in that sort of white-gloved secretary heyday that she inhabited, and what the New York Times writes is one of your specialties, chronicling the vanishing world of working-class Irish Catholics.
Well, my mother really began working in the 20s, and she came from a very working-class, actually Irish and Sicilian family. She had this job as a secretary, which she loved. She had to wear her suits to work. She wore perfume. She had her compacts and her lipstick. She dealt with the world of money, which was by definition a middle-class world, which kind of got her out of her world.
She had girlfriends. She had priests as male friends. She had her faith. In fact, she had sort of a mysticism about her in that, her husband, when she married late, was a convert. They loved to travel to shrines. Her boss, to whom she was devoted, practically converted because of her. So more about the Catholic piece.
My mother had a very serious religious life, and I like very much your saying that she was mystical. She was mystical and she was romantic in that she believed in the invisible. And she had a really quite sophisticated prayer life and intellectual life. She read things that were, you wouldn't expect a working class woman to read. She read spiritual books. She had spiritual practices. And it wasn't just a kind of dumb piety. It was actually on quite a high level.
As others have written, this is sort of a pre-Catholic Church scandal time.
Yeah, and, I'm not saying that the scandals are nothing and shouldn't be marked and acknowledged. They're a terrible blot on the history of the church. However, I like to say that's not the whole story of the Catholic priesthood. And in fact, what priests did for women like my mother was that they took the inner lives of women seriously. They assumed that women had something to say.
This was a time when a priest would come over and you would have a very intellectual conversation about Thomas Aquinas.
Yes, these very ordinary women would sit at the feet, almost literally, of a priest, and he would talk to them about grace and virtue and words that were larger than what are we going to make for supper and what do you think the new skirt length is this year?
But then there was also a mean-spiritedness, sort of a stinginess of spirit in her sisters against her, in her against you.
What she couldn't do was praise me. If you would say, I really hope that I get an A, don't get your hopes up.
You're trying to figure it out in her family, and you write, is this a mix of Irish and American Puritanism, the price of dogma too strictly applied, or is it they receive too little maternal love themselves, replaced by the iron rule of law? What conclusion did you come to? What was that meanness?
I think if I would like to be kind about it, which I don't always like to be kind, I often prefer to be punitive because I have it in me too. I think it's an anxiety, a conviction that they live in a world of scarcity. That breeds envy of somebody who seems to have more than you. So I think it's a mixture of anxiety that the little that you have can easily be lost, and then envy that somebody might have more than you or have it easier than you.
Well, it's interesting you say, you don't want to be nice, you want to be punitive, because
you are unsparing in your anger towards and your hatred of some of your relatives or some of the people that were, you know, around your mom. You turn punitive. You write, "I am punishing. For a writer with my temperament, there's no such thing as a statute of limitations." But I was going to ask you, you know, but then aren't you doing the same thing they did? And you just said you acknowledge that.
I do acknowledge it. The fact that they're dead makes me a little bit better than they are, I guess. But I think I felt so hopelessly protective of my mother while she was alive. I saw that they were hurting her, and I saw that they were hurting her out of the coldness of their hearts. And she was vulnerable because of the warmth of her heart, that her very generosity and openness made her vulnerable to them, and their very coldness and meanness made them invulnerable to her.
She supported the entire family. Yeah. She paid the mortgage on her mother's house. She, as you said, started working as a young girl, even though one leg 6 inches shorter than the other, with polio, a disfigured body.
And then they betrayed her over money. It wasn't even that much money. And I think she had felt her identity was so firmly nested in being a member of that family that when the family turned against her, it broke her. And she never, you know, nobody could put Humpty Dumpty back together again, particularly me.
Mm-hmm. There were friends of hers as well that you felt abandoned her, these close girlfriends. And one of them dies, and you had stopped visiting her at a certain point out of anger. And you make a comment, see if I get it right, where you say, I think I failed her. And someone says to you, no, she set it up so that, you know, she had to be failed. Was there a little of that in your mom, too? Was there a little of that in everybody towards the end?
You know, one of the things about my mother in terms of setting it up, we have to talk about the conscious and the unconscious mind, because my mother never assumed that she had control over her life. She really saw herself as somebody who responded to what was given to her. She would have said God's will. What she did unconsciously, I don't know. But I think she would have said she did her best. And in the end, I like to think she did the best she could. I think that's very important as you age, to say, look, they did the best they could. I think to go on with a mommy dearest trope, you know, after you have your AARP card is a little bit unattractive.
Well, and it's a real generosity of spirit in you, especially since as your mother gets older, well, first of all, a terrible alcoholic.
Yeah.
A fall down on the floor in front of the priest you used to love at family gatherings, alcoholic, and you were the one who had to, you know, pick her up and pile her into the car.
Yeah.
But you forgive her and seem to understand it.
I do, because her life was too hard for her. And she risked being generous. She risked marrying my father. That was a kind of romantic, wild move. That didn't work out so well. But I wouldn't be here if she hadn't taken those risks. So I'm very moved by her generosity and her courage. And I'm deeply saddened by all the forces in her life that militated against her gifts.
Mary Gordon's memoir of her mother, Anna Gagliano Gordon, is Circling My Mother. Mary, thanks so much.
Thank you, Robin.
Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston. I'm Robin Young. Please join us again here and now.
You can listen to Here and Now live each weekday at noon Eastern Time by going to WBUR.org and clicking on the Listen Live button. You can also find us each weekday at noon Eastern on XM Radio Channel 133.